So we take every step we can.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the March 23rd meeting of the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91. Today, we're going to be talking about the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 844. And before we start that off, I'm going to invite Steve Marks, the Executive Director of the OLCC, to provide some framing comments, because we're going to be talking a lot about the good work that you folks have teed up through your listening tours. So welcome. And also Tom Burns, who's the head of marijuana programs for the OLCC.
Madam Chair, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. I just wanted to provide some context on some of the activities we've had going. As you know, we concluded the 11 listening sessions around the state, very well attended, over 4,000 people. So we conclude the last one up in Portland. We promised you at one point an interim report, but because it was incomplete, we decided to wait till we finished the last four of the hearings to do that. So you will get from us an updated full report on the listening sessions, and we're preparing that. On the appointment of the Rules Advisory Committee, we had talked about moving forward with that. Some people anticipated that that would happen mid-month. We have over 500 applications to be on the rack. We're working through those, so we won't get that accomplished this week. Probably be beginning of next week before we appoint at least the overhead rack, and maybe not the full subcommittee structure working on that. Commission meets this week. They have an agenda that is primarily focused on education. They're going to look to catch up, I think, some for the overall commission on the laboratories issue. On growers and processors, so we won't have any decision making going forward, but mainly reporting to the commission and educating them in preparation for rules adoption. So with that, I thank you for your hard work on 844 and putting us in a position to move forward.
Mr. Burns, would you like to add anything?
Co-chairs Tom Burns for the Director of the Medical Marijuana Program for the OLCC. At this point, no. We'll answer any questions you have about the technical amendments and how you want to tell me how you want to proceed.
Fantastic. Well, I would like to first, before we pivot to the actual bill, I want to thank you and your agency for the tremendous outreach work you've done. You know, 4,000 people. I really like the interactive approach that you used. You've generated good information. You've really helped help us all move this forward as we try to work through implementation. So thank you. I'm sure it's been a lot of work, and we really appreciate it. All right. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 844. The Dash 1 amendments were received on the 20th, and I'm going to ask, we have neither a fiscal impact or a revenue impact on the bill at this time, but we've got a whole bunch of content that we hope to enlist your feedback on, and I'm going to ask Committee Administrator Adam Crawford to describe for us the scope of the bill and the amendments.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 844 requires premises licensed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, or OLCC, to only receive marijuana products from other OLCC-licensed businesses. The committee is asked to consider the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments replace the measure. They clarify powers and duties of the OLCC related to marijuana regulation. They prohibit OLCC from licensing marijuana growers, processors, wholesalers, or retailers within 1,000 feet of a public or private school for which attendance is compulsory. They confirm the validity of a license if a public or private school for which attendance is compulsory is established within 1,000 feet of a licensee, provides peace officer authority to authorize OLCC employees. They require the OLCC to adopt rules establishing testing laboratory licenses, standards for marijuana testing, and test result reporting. They require the OLCC to adopt rules defining classification of marijuana processors. They allow the OLCC to require segregation of activities at premises holding multiple licenses, requires the holder license to hold and maintain liability insurance and bond. There allows the OLCC to require a marijuana retailer to use age verification scanner equipment. They allow the OLCC to impose civil penalty that does not exceed $5,000 on a licensee for each day rule violations occur. It establishes the Marijuana Enforcement Fund as the credited fund of the civil penalty, clarifies the authority of other state agencies related to marijuana, requires the State Board of Pharmacy to establish rule containing instructions for disposal of marijuana left behind at all retail drug outlets, requires the OLCC to submit a report on the influence of marijuana on the ability, person's ability to drive to interim legislative committees of the Legislative Assembly on or before January 1st, 2017. It defines terms, and finally, it declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
So there's a lot to think about here, which is exciting and wonderful and a testament to great work that you've done. I am going to call the witnesses in the order that they appear on our sheet, and then at the end I expect that we'll invite you two back to the front to respond to questions, unless you have more comment that you wanted to walk through now on the front end.
Madam Chair, co-chairs, for the record again, Tom Burns, Director of Medical Programs for the OLCC. Your committee staff put out a wonderful document. I just wanted to point out that there are three things that you had said you wanted in here that aren't in here. I didn't find anything that you didn't want in here. But the service permit, the electronic fund transfer, and the issue of where the first plant or seed comes from is not in here. And so we can work with your staff to figure out how to write that, or maybe you choose not to include it. But those were the list that your committee administrator put together. Those three are missing.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. What was the second item?
It was the server permit, the electronic fund transfer for the payment of taxes, and the last one was the went out of my mind. What did I just say?
Or the first plant or seed.
Oh, we're the first, immaculate conception.
The virgin birth, I think they call it.
All right. Well, that's wonderful. So with that, then, I'll transition to having public comment, but I suspect that we would love to ask you more questions as we move forward after hearing from community members on the draft. May we have, please, Ed Bergman's Kimberly McCullough come to the witness stand first, and then on deck we have Mary Botkin, Judy Mercers, and Jeff Sugarman. Hi. Mr. Bergmans, please state your name for the record and let us know what you're thinking about.
My name is Ed Bergmans. I'm the owner of AMC Consulting. The reason I'm here today, I have... Well, actually, what I'd like to talk about is everybody here wants to see what we can do about bringing the entire medical or the entire marijuana industry into being legal. I think if we were to, we have an opportunity at this point, and I think what we can do is if we invite the medical marijuana people to actually participate in whatever they have left, what they don't give to their patients, be able to make a profit at it, be able to sell this product to, let's say, the processors that OLCC would set up, that would take a big chunk out of the black market that currently exists today. I've talked to probably dozens of growers, and they all tell me exactly the same thing, that they wish that they could had a place to get rid of it. Right now, the only place that we can get rid of it is through the black market or to take it to a dispensary. If you take it to a dispensary, they typically hang on to it for weeks at a time. They want you to turn the product over, and then after they sell it, you come back and get your money. A lot of these places, you know, they'll have it for 3-4 weeks. It becomes dated. They want you to take half of it back. Some of them don't pay. So a lot of the growers just won't deal with the dispensaries at all. And that just feeds, once again, feeds that black market. What I propose, and what I've proposed to all the growers, is if we gave everybody the same price, let's say if if you have the recreational guy that grows four plants or somebody that grew 40 plants for 4,000, that doesn't really make any difference. But we pay through the processors $125, let's say, per ounce. Fair market price is $200. That leaves $75 to take care of the processor. You could take care of the retail establishment and pay state and federal taxes with what's left. Everybody I've talked to has told me that they don't really want to deal with the black market or friends of friends. And, you know, there's an awful lot of exposure to families, you know, crime, the ripoffs, the money that has to be in people's houses. These are all conditions that, that exist in the black market that we're trying to resolve. Every one of the growers I've talked to have said that's a no-brainer. They would it equates to $2,000 a pound for the average individual that does grow at this point. That's a pretty good profit, and they're happy with that. And they realize that if they were to sell it to and get their taxes paid, one, they become legal. Two, they don't have to deal with all the dangers that goes along with it. And there's still enough money to take care of the logistic end of it, you know, the state taxes and the testing and all that kind of thing. The other thing that I would recommend is if there was a way that we could put the testing and the processing in the same location, you save a lot of overhead. And the whole idea is that if we can provide it in the stores for the same amount of money that we would have to pay for it on the black market, then obviously without the additional headaches of trying to get rid of it and everything, nobody's going to stay with the black market. The product would naturally flow to these processors. There's always going to be a black market. There's always going to be people that are going to try to that are opportunists, and they're going to break the laws anyway. But I think there's a large community of growers in the state that would love to be part of a legitimate system that are now on the medical side of it. And what they've told me is that they would love to have an opportunity to actually fold what's left over from their patients into a legitimate channel. So.
Great. Well, thank you for giving us that thoughtful framework. Ms. McCullough, would you like to?
Yeah. Chair Lininger and Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough, and I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I just want to bring your attention to three sections of the bill that cause us a little bit of concern and which I think could be fixed. First, if you look at Section 9, and I don't know if you guys have the amendment in front of you, but Section 9, it's on page 11 and starting on line 27. That requires identification to be checked for all sales of marijuana, even if there is no reasonable doubt that the purchaser is over 21 years of age. Then also Section 16, which is on page 16, line 20, it allows the OLCC to require marijuana sellers to use ID scanners to verify that purchasers are over 21 years of age. So, first of all, you know, if folks have a voluntary policy that they're using scanners, we certainly don't have a problem with that. But it's the combination of these two sections that causes concern. If everyone is getting their ID checked, regardless of who they are, regardless of if they're 70 years old or 80 years old, and very, very clearly over the legal age, and they're using scanners, and everyone is required to use scanners, then that means that this bill is actually in conflict with already existing Oregon law. I provided you with, if you look in your materials there, I provided you with the statute that was passed in, 2009, by the legislature related to the use of the swipers. And as some of you may recall, the reason that this is in place is because those swipers can essentially, they pose privacy problems, and there have been breaches of data related to the IDs that have been used in the scanners. And so there's legislative findings, essentially finding that, our personal information that's contained in our IDs is confidential information, and that there is danger of identity theft because of these card swipers. And for that reason, there's restrictions that are placed on the use of the swipers. And the restrictions essentially are that you can only use them in certain circumstances. So, for example, if you're going to buy something with a credit card, they can use the swiper to verify your identity, that it's the same, that it's a valid ID with that credit card, right? And they can't keep that information afterwards, but they can use it to verify that it's the same as the credit card. Similarly, if there's reasonable doubt that you're not 21, which, I don't know exactly what the age is, but it's somewhere around 30 or something like that, then it can be used to verify your age. But again, that information can't be kept and can't be sold or transmitted. So if we set up this system, it essentially would put marijuana sellers in the position of violating this provision. So we would, and also in addition to that, there doesn't seem to be any reason that I can think of that people who are clearly over 21 would need to have their identification taken unless that information is being kept for some reason, which is a violation of the law. So that's the first section. The second section is the penalty provision, and it may just be that these penalties were put in here because they're sort of the canned penalty language that gets put into every bill, but I am a bit concerned that $5,000 per day per violation could add up to a huge amount of money very, very quickly. If you think about some of the violations in here where, they're growing in the same place that they're manufacturing, well, we discover that happened 6 months down the line, and we have $5,000 for every day. I mean, that could get pretty ludicrous pretty quick. So I have provided you the analogous alcohol regulations or the alcohol statutes and ORS 471-990 provides that the civil penalties that can be imposed for a violation of OLCC rules is a Class C violation. I then provided you with that schedule, and Class C violations are essentially $500 for individuals, $1,000 for corporations, and it's a $160 presumptive fine, and that is not per day, that's per violation. So we would just suggest that something analogous to alcohol be imposed. I mean, if it's not the exact same amount, that's not a concern, but it is if it's this amount that could really blow up very, very quickly. So that's all I'd like to say. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Does anyone have questions for this panel?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bird.
I wanted to ask Mr. Bergman's how, a little bit more detail, how this system would work. You're talking about medical growers here?
Yes, ma'am, I am. Basically...
And just before you start, and are you contemplating medical growers feeding only into medical dispensaries?
No, ma'am. I believe that most of the product, like Senator Farioli mentioned last week, a half a million people that use marijuana, if they bought $200 a month, we're talking about $1.2 billion that's just floating around in the black market. What I propose is that, a percentage of this will naturally go to recreational. But my thoughts were that a lot of people are going to stay in the medical based on the fact that they can grow more plants, they can grow more product, and that product's still going to end up in the black market. If we were to take and actually offer these people to come in and go to the processing place, that's where it would come in, we'd actually have a place that we could inventory most of the marijuana that's being produced. We'd be able to tax it at that point. We'd have some kind of an inventory control system at that same location. In that process, we're keeping the price of the end product low enough that the black market's not going to be able to compete. That's the intent behind it. I think the existing growers that are out there now are in favor of taking a little bit less money and giving up the taxes and some money for other people to make a profit, let's say the processors and the retail outlets, based on the fact that they don't want to be illegal. It's a pain in the neck for them. They just assume they have a place to take it and say, here you go. And once again, we strike a pretty good blow to the black market at that point.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much for your time and your input. Appreciate it. So next up we have Mary Botkin, Judy Mercers, and Jeff Sugarman, please. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Please state your name for the record and let us know what we should be thinking about.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, Leninger and Burdick. We're here, Mary Botkin for the record, and I'm here this evening representing the Oregon Infused Topicals Association. They testified several weeks ago in front of the committee, and we have more questions than testimony. We have questions about definitions and the need to have topical products sort of tightly defined in the bill so that it is clear that topical products are a little different than other products that will be sold on the open market. We sent the committee, and it is attached to the system. A copy of the definitions for topical products that we worked with Representative Olson and other members of the committee to get done. And we've met with pretty much everybody on the committee about the subject. And we're, I guess our question is it where will the definitions go and how will they be defined? And if you look at the definitions that we had drafted, it seems to us that it would fit into this bill on page 4 in sub 16, sub A, page 3. And just curious about how that process is going to work and how best we can work with the committee to make sure that the folks that we represent don't sort of get lost in the mix of other definitions or other marijuana products they currently are being sold through the medical system. And at the end of their processing, there is no longer any hypoactive ingredients left in their products, so they are significantly different than some of the other products available, and these ladies would like to be able to expand their market a bit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to have everyone testify, and then I bet people will have questions on this theme, so thank you. Ms. Mercers?
Actually, Madam Chair, my name is Judy Merens, M-E-H-R-E-N-S, and I'm here supporting Mary, and I'm just ready to answer any questions. I'm also representing the Oregon Infused Topicals Association. So.
Co-Chairs Leininger and Senator Burdick, my name is Jeff Sugarman. I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon Cannabis Pact tonight on Senate Bill 844 and appreciate the opportunity to do that. We just want to highlight several areas that we have questions or concerns about, and a couple of them I might suggest that might be appropriate to move into the more policy-oriented side of the bill. First, in the definition section, we actually really like the change that's been done to the definition of an immature plant. We think it's very positive to define an immature plant as something that's in a vegetative state and not flowering versus a flowering plant, and get away from the idea that anything over 12 inches tall is a mature plant. We think that's a great change, and we hope that that gets extended both to the recreational and the medical markets. Also in definitions, we noticed that there was a removal of the definition of a person. And we're just curious as to what benefit that has or what impact that would have on the overall system, and just would like to throw that out there as something we'd like to see answered at some point there. In sections 11 and 12, we deal with packaging and licensure. We believe at the Cannabis PAC that only if a person intends to be solely a packager, in other words, accept product from a producer or another kind of processor and then repackage that material and then sell it, should they be required to get a license. But for growers or producers and processors who want to package themselves, we feel strongly that they should be able to have the ability to package without a separate license, provided, of course, that they meet all of the OLCC regulations that are put in place. So we'd like the committee to consider that aspect of the producer and processor's license as it relates to packaging. In section 13 of the bill, we deal with bonding and liability insurance. This is an area that has raised a lot of questions among our members. While we're not opposed at all to the idea of bonding, we have some questions. How was $300,000 determined as the right level for that bond? That seems very high to us. Will bond companies be willing to issue these bonds to an industry that is not necessarily considered legal by the federal government? And indeed, what price will they charge? For some bonds, that price can be 1 to 4% of the total amount of the bond. In other cases, we've heard that it could be up as high as between 10 and 20%. We have long believed and said to this committee that we believe we should include as many of the small and medium-sized growers in this new adult-use market as we possibly can. And I think we need to be very careful that we don't set bonding and insurance limits at a level that's going to price them out of the market and push them right back into the illegal market. So that's an area that's one of the areas we think is ripe for much more discussion and research and might be better off in a policy area here. Section 15 deals with the whole issue of age restrictions, and of course we understand and agree 100% that adult use over 21 is essential. We do agree with the ACLU that there are questions about the age verification and particularly data mining, and we would like to see some accommodation in that area. But more importantly, we do have a class of Oregonians under the age of 21 that are legally allowed to possess a valid medical marijuana card and acquire marijuana for their condition. And we wonder if this isn't an area, this section isn't an area where we ought to put that exclusion in, so that a medical marijuana patient who has a valid card but is under the age of 21, between the ages of 18 and 21, would actually be allowed to go into a retail shop. As you know, we've long believed that a single system that would allow retailers to serve both markets is at least one of the options we'd like to see, and this might be a place where we ought to make sure that the younger valid medical marijuana patients are protected as well. In section 31 deals with the police powers granted to OLCC. We think that there are many different enforcement issues with cannabis than with alcohol, and that this is definitely an area that deserves further discussion and further research, and we would recommend moving that out of the technical bill into the policy side as well. Similarly, Section 63, which rewrites a bit of the taxation language and restates what Measure 91 said in the first place in terms of local taxation and ordinances. We hope that this is the first step towards strong preemptive language, making it prohibitive for local governments to add additional taxes or opt out in any way not allowed by statute. We also want to make sure that nothing in this precludes the ability of this legislature to move the tax from the growers level to the retail level, and that may also figure into that discussion as well. And finally, sections 91 through 93 seem to allow the OLCC to hold back on issuing rules for all processed materials, all concentrates, all edibles. I'm not sure that that's what the OLCC asked for, but in any case, we think that that would be a very dangerous thing to push back the entire concentrate markets back at least a year or so from the operation of the retail markets. This is a big market on the medical side. This is going to be a very big market on the recreational side. And while we agree that we need to get these rules right, taking a year and a half to allow those for sale in the recreational market will spur the black market in those two areas. And it will be very difficult once that market gets a foothold to bring those people back into the recreational market. So we urge a great deal of caution in allowing the OLCC to push back those rules for all processors for another full year. And finally, again, we agree with the ACLU on the size of that penalty. $5,000 a day seems extremely excessive and would simply drive people out of business if they ran afoul of some of these rules. And we thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We have several questions. Representative Olson, why don't you go first?
Okay,
and then
thank
we have
you,
Representative
Chair.
Buckley.
So, Jeff, to you. Appreciate your testimony and looking at the one piece that you have here on bonding. You kind of throw out there a little bit of what you're thinking of a little bit, but I'm curious, have you considered the bonding reflect the size of the operation?
Co-Chair Leininger, Representative Olson, I think we do need to have a good discussion about what that bond should be set at. What's their expected tax rate? I think the OLCC had testified that they want that bond specifically to be able to go after the taxes that might be due or potentially fines that might be due. So I would think that we could make a solid analysis of what we expect that tax to be and make some determinations about what the right level of bonding would be. And at the same time, we really do need to make sure that there are people who are going to write those bonds.
Okay, and then I just have another question, not of Jeff, but of Mary. So, Mary, I'm trying to remember the testimony earlier. Does Washington and Colorado have where you're wanting to go with the topics?
Madam Chairs, Representative Olson, perhaps Judy can answer this more fully, but my understanding is that in Washington, the topical issue was ignored or forgotten and did not get included, and they are now working on including topical products. And we are trying to avoid that same error here in Oregon so that topicals are clearly defined from the beginning and everybody sort of knows what we're talking about. Okay. Does that answer your question?
That does.
Thank you.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Jeff, in the section about police powers granted, to help us jumpstart that serious conversation, can you give me just a couple examples of your concern about what the difference between cannabis and liquor enforcement might be?
Co-Chair Leininger, Representative Buckley, thank you. I think there's often a consideration that these retail outlets are going to operate more like bars. I think there's tremendous law enforcement issues around bars or places where people can't consume and then leave and go home. I think what we're talking about here are retail stores, and I think that they operate much more like a liquor store than they do a bar. And I think that to me is the area where we need to at least have some discussions about what that police power looks like.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. On your last point about the edibles and extractions, I think the main concern has been over edibles as opposed to extractions. I was talking to Mazin in the Legislative Revenue Office today, and he was making the point that there wasn't much of a black market for edibles like there are some of the other items. Could you see a a provision where maybe we held back on edibles but let extractions go ahead, because those issues are different. You don't have the children's issue and some of the other issues.
Co-Chair Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick, we agree with that. Edibles is a different area. It seems to me that giving a full year to draft those rules may be quite a long time, and there is going to be a demand for that in the market, in the marketplace. A lot of people do make edibles at home, but we do have some thriving companies out there that are working in the medical marijuana industry that certainly would like the opportunity to go into the recreational market under some tight restrictions. Yes, I think yes to the question about exclusively applying it to edibles and perhaps even looking at a shorter time frame, since we're only dealing with this one issue here.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Representative
Wilson. Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. Yeah, I think one of the offshoots from the discussions that we've had, and the fact that many people from around the state have been following these discussions for a long time, has led to some interest in these products that perhaps hasn't been seen before. And so that's why I would agree. I think we have to be kind of careful about spending a lot of time putting together rules, especially for things like edibles, because I do think there's an increasing interest in that now, so we better catch up with that, I think.
Senator Prezzani.
Jeff, in your presentation regarding your second point on the Section 11 and 12 regarding the licenses, I didn't hear you say anything about retailers, and it would seem to me that potentially you would have product that could be delivered from a grower to a retailer, and that it would be in a large quantity that would be broken down for individual sales. So I'm assuming you would want retailers to also have that ability without having a separate packaging license?
Co-Chair Leininger, Senator Prezzanski, you're exactly correct on that. Yes, sir.
Any other questions? I would love to hear, Mr. Sugarman, so in terms of extra time if needed for concentrates and edibles, do you think that, would you suggest 6 months instead? Would you suggest it only for edibles? You've identified the issue, and if there is a solution that you think is the best approach, it would be great to hear you speak that.
Co-Chair Leininger, I do believe that you should limit it to edibles and not all concentrates. I think that we can get to the place we need to get with edibles in far less than a year. Whether it's 6 months or 3 months, that's something I want to have some discussions about with the OLCC folks who are going to be in charge of this, because But I do think that we can get those rules done in a short period of time and really work to try and get those in place before the actual retail shops open, and I think we can do that.
Any other comments? I think that's a great point that we're trying to deal with, we're trying to move people out of the black market, so if we wait too long, we undermine ourselves on some level. Senator Prezzanski.
Yeah, just follow up on that. I unfortunately did not get a chance to go through the amendments, so I don't know them as well as some of the people here on the dais tonight. But looking at the sections that Jeff's brought forward as to modifying the time for drafting rules specifically in edibles or in extracts, my understanding is that we're going to give the this bill is going to go through relatively fast, so OLCC is going to be able to start doing the rules they need to make. I'd like to have comment when they come back up as to exactly what the time frame is for the different rules sections they're going to be doing, because I'm not sure what the justification is, because what I think I'm hearing is a year beyond whatever point, and that to me means if we're not going to have product at retail until October or September of 2016, are we talking about a year beyond that? I need some clarifications, because as Representative Wilson says, this is going to get away from us really quick if we're not maintaining some type of oversight and ensuring, and there may be other ways to, let's say, take care of this problem without needing to delay the rulemaking to that length of time.
That's a great point. Ms. Botkin and Ms. Marins, I have your letter to us here. Is the amendment to House Bill 2040, would that get done, the modification that you think is needed in order to deal with topicals? And could you just summarize for the committee what you think needs to happen in terms of definition to get it from where the default position is now to what you'd be comfortable with? And if I'm putting you on the spot and you would rather not answer that now, that's okay.
I think if you look at page 3, excuse me, Madam Chairs, members of the committee, Mary Botkin again for the record. If you look at page 3 of the attached amendments to House Bill 2040, which we did not drop, if you look at on that page, that definition meets our needs. And I just want to say that this is a product which now is only available through the medical marijuana program, and it is the desire of our clients, since it does not have any psychotropic effect, the only effect that it has is medicinal or pain relief, if you will, that they be allowed to, once their product is complete, that they be allowed to sell beyond just the OLCC outlets. You know, their client base is an older, more mature client that may not be as comfortable shopping in a marijuana store as they would be in alternative treatment facilities through, you know, help me, Judy.
Holistic.
Through holistic and alternative medicine, through house parties or whatever. I mean, it is what they're wanting to do is to be able to expand that market and make their product available to a client base that is not necessarily someone who would frequent an OLCC marijuana store. And I say that understanding that there are people who are willing to go there, they're going there now, and thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Yes.
I'm sorry, I just can't pass this one. House parties? Is this going to be with Tupperware and what else?
Well, you can get Tupperware. You can use the Tupperware to store your.
Got it.
No. I have no idea. You know, I know that our clients have, one of our clients has an MBA. I trust her implicitly to be able to figure out what her market is and how to access it.
Avon will never be the same.
Avon with a little extra help. Thank you, Senator Brzezinski, for a moment of humor.
Brevity. Oh, my God.
All right, thank you. I think we don't have any more questions for this panel, so we'll invite, so thank you for being here. And it would be great to have the two gentlemen from OLCC come back up, or at least Mr. Burns, however you two want to work that. To respond to additional questions that folks may have based on what we have just heard from the witnesses. If you would like to start by responding to what you heard, that'd be great.
Sure. Co-chairs and members, Tom Burns, Director of Marijuana Programs for the OLCC. since I have in front of me the draft amendments to 2040, 20, whatever, the Ms. Botkin's amendments. There are clearly salves and gels and lotions in the medical marijuana market today, and I envision in the recreational market there'll be salves, gels, and lotions in the recreational market. I think they make a good point that the definition does not include that, and I think when we look at the definition of what a marijuana product is, we might want to include something like that. I am a little concerned when Ms. Botkin goes on and says that they would like to be able to sell outside of a licensed OLCC product, retail establishment. Unfortunately, The federal government uses the word marijuana in the Cole memo and does not distinguish whether the marijuana is a THC heavy marijuana or a CBD heavy marijuana. And I am perfectly willing to accept what they say on face value, that they go through a process and take out all of the THC, leaving only CBDs. But in the world of the Cole memo, marijuana is marijuana. And I think that we need to be careful that we not open up a marketplace that would allow product to be outside of the OLCC licensed delivery system. But I do agree that the definition belongs someplace.
So that's helpful. So I hear a partial affirmation there of what they're proposing. So that's good. Go ahead. Any other thoughts?
Let me go through Mr. Sugarman's comments. The bonding issue. I would say that the bonding language got drafted overly broad. It was our request of you that you draft language that allowed us to require a bond for the business that has a tax liability. And on the alcohol side, we own the alcohol product as it flows through the various licensed facilities. And so there should be a bond on the alcohol side. On the marijuana side, we don't own the marijuana. It is a private transaction between businesses. All we asked for was the ability to impose a bond on whatever business level the tax is imposed. Right now, that tax is only on the producers or growers. So the language in here should only reference the growers, and it references all four of the licenses. It should only reference the growers. And so I think that would solve most of Jeff's concerns. $300,000, I don't know what the right number is. I think one of you suggested that we figure out what their tax liability might be over an annual period and impose a bond based on that. And we're perfectly willing to work and believe we can do that by rule that would set bonding levels. We agree we do not want to put barriers for people who are trying to move into the business, but that the bond needs to be there. If you have a $100,000 tax liability over the course of a year, that you should have a $100,000 bond. So if you walk, we can collect that. Or something similar.
Any comments on that, Representative Buckley?
Right, Ms. Burns, just a question about are we sure that they'll be able to acquire bonds?
Co-chairs and Representative Buckley, that's a very valid question. I guess I would comment the same way I would comment if you asked me about banking. And we've talked in the past about banking and in the draft rules that we are currently developing. We're putting in there that the applicants, the businesses have to have a relationship with a bank and prove to us that. By putting that out today, it will drive the market. And whether in November it stays in place or not is a question that we can debate in November. We may have to pull that out. What we asked for was the authority to impose a bond, not require a bond. And the language here also does require the bond to be placed. We wanted the authority to impose a bond if we felt it was necessary, and if, as you point out, there is in fact a business out there that will write
that makes sense.
The bond.
Thank you, Chair.
Would it meet your needs if there were some caveat that provided that in the event bonding is not available to this market, that affects the requirement, just so that we can build in the safety valve?
Co-Chair Leininger, that's a perfect solution to leave that safety valve in. Yeah.
And Madam Chair, thank you. As you know, there'll be a serious discussion over changing the point of taxation to a point of sale. Would it work in, do you need this language right away, or would it more properly belong in a tax discussion?
Co-chairs and Senator Burdick, like I said, the only issue is by making the statement earlier in the process, it says to the market out there, mm-hmm. we're going to be coming to you for bonds. Delay it a month, I don't know, it's a problem. But the way
actually that makes sense. So would it work in a technical sense to just do as you said and just say in the technical bill that bonding will be required at the point of taxation rather than saying grower?
That would, yes.
Okay, yeah. We'll make a note of that. Thank you.
Any other questions on bonding? Okay.
So going on. Excuse me, Representative Buckley and Senator Farioli have been We won't go any further.
What's that mean?
It's on you. I've come down with whatever ails them.
I resemble that remark.
Really do.
Both the ACLU and Mr. Sugarman raised the issue of who should be allowed inside a retail establishment. The language in here was designed to simply say, we don't believe there should be any minors inside a retail establishment, period. That then raises the question of what to do with the 18, 19, and 20-year-old medical card holders who have the right to buy medical marijuana. At this point, there is still the medical side of the world, and so to the extent that that exists, I think they can go over there. They could not go into a retail establishment even if they had a card. And again, it is just designed to address the Cole memo, which says, figure out how you're going to address the kids' problem. And I get it. I look like I'm old, and I'm probably over 21. But you know what? So does a lot of people who wear makeup. And I'm sorry. You know, you can age yourself or not age yourself. I don't know that people are going to do this far. But we believe that you should not be able to enter one of these retail establishments without showing that you are in fact over the age of 21. That brings the issue of card readers. I have no idea what a card reader is or how it works, but I am told, I thought all they did was verify that the license that was presented was, in fact, a license that was valid. I did not understand that it went out and checked some massive database and came back. I'll tell you a little story. My now 20-year-old son went out to dinner with me and said, I'm going to buy a drink tonight because, see, I have this a license from New York that shows that I'm 22 years old. We said, no, you're not going to get a drink. I work for the Olds, and I see you can't do this. But the point is, he had a license. I am assuming that the card readers would be able to look at that and say, that's not a valid license, far more than somebody looking at it who says, oh, yeah, I see, I can do the math, and it looks like. That's what I thought the card reader is, and if it's not, we'd be happy to work with ACLU. Steve, you know card readers because they're used on the alcohol side.
Just a little bit. Let me step in. For the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. I'd say this, that we do have a lot of fake IDs going around, so this age verification equipment is really important in the alcohol realm. What we can do is we'll get back to you on what the database is it queries, but because it's specific to age ID, so I'll get that information on who it touches, how it touches, and what information it provides to you.
Great. And we have questions from Senator Cruz and Senator Pozanski, probably following up.
I guess when I'm looking at verification, by the way, Tom, there's no way in hell I would think you're under 21. even with my glasses off. So I guess you can go into a liquor store and purchase, and you have a process of checking on your liquor stores to find out if they are being doing due diligence. Why couldn't a system like that work here too? Do you think we really run foul of Cole if you have a process in place to check on the stores?
Co-chair Senator Cruz, I think the question is, should a minor even be allowed in the stores? So the first question is, do we push it back to the door, or do we require when they say, I want that product, and the business then has to ID them at that point after they're already in, or they've come in with somebody and they say, hey, buy that for me, that's what I want, and he's over 21 and I'm not. Our first goal was to keep them outside of the store in the first place. And as Mr. Mark says, verifying that the license is a valid license is something that I don't understand.
Just a follow-up. Okay, so I take my kid into a liquor store, and he said, that's the bottle I want, and then I buy it for him, right? I mean, I'm trying to parse out what the difference would be as far as, I mean, these are licensed state facilities that they can be or they can't be, but you know, I mean, you have a contract with them. The liquor stores?
Liquor stores, yes.
Yes, yeah. Okay. I'm saying if we set up a parallel track, it could be the same sort of oversight as we have for liquor, and that might work without being too heavily handed, I would think. I'm thinking outside the box a little bit here, so.
Madam Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, we don't require age verification for all transactions.
Right.
We do use it as a sanction, as was suggested in the testimony, as well as at times industries will use the age verification as an incentive in advance of a penalty against OLCC for sales to minors. So they have an option. I think we did, and this, if I recall, asked for discretion to require ID outside. So there's some ways in which you can employ this technology to control access.
So Senator Prezonsky and then Co-Chair Burdick.
So Steve, and the readers that are being used by OLCC, do you know the process well enough to kind of describe it for us so tonight?
Madam Chair, Senator Prezonsky, no, not well enough. I want to get you better information than I could give you.
When you look at it, I know that for credit cards, we're in this process of doing this transformation of having encrypted cards. Okay. And I'm wondering whether or not where our state license, driver's license are at today, or ID cards, if that's going to be something that's going to be moved into that, and also just the process of how it works, because it seems like there could be some checks and balances, and I'm not sure if that is more safe for ACLU's concerns or not.
Madam Chair, I'm kind of mulling over your point about the Cole memorandum and the danger of allowing anyone under 21 in a recreational facility. So that under the 18 to 21 year olds would be, because under 18 they have to be with a parent or a guardian. They would actually be able to go into a medical facility, or they could have a relationship with a grower, or they could grow their own
or a caregiver.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think we would really be limiting their options a whole lot by this kind of stance. And to respond to Senator Cruz, I think the difference between alcohol and marijuana for this context is alcohol is not a Schedule I drug, and that's what we keep bumping up against in this committee is the fact that we have the constant reminder that the federal government is going to be watching what we do, and keeping it away from kids is going to be probably close to the top of their list.
Yes.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to weigh in on this a little bit, too. I mean, I'm looking at the Cole memo, and I'm just kind of walking away from this thinking that we could mirror that of what you guys are doing, right, what OLCC is doing right now with alcohol. I think that that would suffice. So.
Me, too.
I'd be interested in hearing what Ms. McCullough thinks about that, if you wouldn't mind coming back up.
Well, that would actually, Madam Chair, play into what Kimberly was sharing. So,
could I ask for clarification? Are you saying that you think that under 21 should be allowed in the recreational?
No. For subject of purchasing.
Okay. Got it.
Do you feel like you have a clear sense of what Representative Olson is suggesting? I'd just love to hear if you feel like that would address the ACLU's needs.
Chair Lidinger, if I understand correctly, you're saying essentially to mirror what we do with alcohol.
Yeah.
So, that's exactly what we're suggesting as well. Mm-hmm. And just to provide a little bit of clarification about the swipers, it's not that when you swipe it, it sends it somewhere else and we're concerned about that. It's that the swipers have been used to steal people's information. And so there's a danger when those swipers are used of people having their personal information stolen. And because of that concern, the legislature decided to limit the uses of the swipers. So you can only use them in certain circumstances. For example, making sure that people are over 21.
Okay. So I think, yes, sir, Senator Prezonsky.
Kim, can you walk through, I heard your presentation earlier about the swipers in the sense of it has a memory and it's being stored there, or is it actually being somehow telecommunicated to some other storage or what?
If the swipers are being used properly, they don't store the information because under current Oregon law, they're not allowed to. But they can be fixed essentially to do that, and that has occurred, and that was part of what prompted this legislation.
That happened here in the state?
My understanding, I haven't looked at the actual case, but from talking to Dave Fedenke about this a couple days ago, he said there was a case in Portland where it occurred.
It's illegal.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I feel like we've gotten some good problem solving, and perhaps we've evolved this to go in the same direction as with alcohol. Thank you. Do you want to comment on that, or do you want to move on to the next issue? Or yes, sir. Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair, Steve Marks for the record. So I just want to say we check IDs for servers outside bars where you're posted where minors cannot be outside the doors. For sales, it's different, right? We check at the point of sale.
Okay. Thank you.
Going on, the issue of processors and the delay in rules and the ability to delay this. I think the language in the amendment was probably drafted too broadly. It was our desire to simply ask that the issue of edibles be delayed, that we don't have to issue rules until January of 17. That allows us to allow the extract processors, to allow the lotion makers, to allow anybody who made something that was not an edible to move forward with their product. But because of the controversy around edibles, because of the ease in which you can overdose with an edible, because of the ease in which the labeling on those packages, we're just a little concerned that with everything else that we might not be able to have a well-thought-out system up and ready to go by January of 16 in time to start accepting applications. So our thought was to simply delay the edibles until January of 17. That's the second time around for the applicants. And by that time, we would have good rules. The applicants would, the product would be available in the market as soon as the applicant applied. We could move them forward in the market. So it would not be a one-year delay. It would be more like a six-month delay for the product to get into the market.
Question?
Yes, sir.
You're referring to the recreational side.
Absolutely.
So you would not necessarily interfere with the medical side on edibles?
Co-chairs and Senator Ferrioli, as this bill is drafted, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Buckley, Senator Prezanski.
Tom, it'd be helpful if there was like a list of questions that OSC feels need to be answered in terms of edibles. I mean, is it simply THC content and what is child-proof packaging? Are those the two issues, or are there several more? It'd be helpful to find out what you're concerned about in terms of the length of time to write the rules around the edibles.
Sure. Co-chairs and Representative Buckley, why don't we come back on Wednesday with that list for you, or we'll submit it to the committee with that list. It's those issues. It's the issues as well of you know, a kitchen. What goes on? So right now, if you make a brownie, you have to have FDA-approved labeling on what's in that brownie. Mm-hmm. This is a brownie that is made for consumption, but has marijuana in it. Can we force them to use the FDA-approved labeling, given that this is a product that would technically be adulterated in the eyes of the FDA? What do you do about how much THC should be in any one product? Is it 10 micrograms, is 100 micrograms, is 1,000 micrograms. How many doses should be in one product? What does the packaging look like? These are all issues that, quite frankly, we're still wrestling with. But we'll come back with a list for you.
Thank you.
Senator Prezanski.
Yeah, thank you for that, because that list is going to be very important for us to understand exactly what needs to be done, because it seems to me that some of the stuff, knowing the drafts that are here or the bills that have been introduced, some of them have already started working on setting and spotting those areas and issues, specifically as to the health conditions of a kitchen, that they have to hit certain standards. So I think we've got a lot of that guidelines, but it would be nice to have that. The other part, Tom, I want to go back to, and Senator Ferrioli asked about the edibles in the marijuana medical side, and you stated the way the bill is drafted now is it wouldn't go there. Let's just put this on the record. OLCC is not looking to go into the medical marijuana arena. Is that correct?
Right.
Co-chairs and Senator Przanski, that is correct.
Thank you.
Good point, Floyd.
Any other comments on this?
Yeah, absolutely.
I drafted or co-submitted a bill that would actually grant extra time for rulemaking, or we were trying to get it granting extra time for rulemaking around edibles. But based on what Mr. Sugarman said, I have to say that I am a little concerned that if we were to wait until January 2017, and it's almost January 2015 now. I mean, we're just 3 months past the beginning of 2015. That we run a risk of undermining our ability to help direct consumers to the adult use recreational market if we leave a really big component of products that people want to get off the table in adult use recreational until January 2017. So while I believe that you should have the extra time you need to do a really responsible job, since Colorado has been working on this, it's quite a long time from January 2016, even now. I'm a little uncertain about whether that amount of time seems like the right. Thank you. Yes?
To the comment that you're making in the time frame, it's clear that the dispensaries have done, the folks operating in the dispensary world have done extensive R&D in edibles and can probably dictate with great precision what some standards ought to be for the recreational side. So I would suggest we've got a perfect laboratory already in operation, that we need to draw from. And I would suggest that even though there's no contemplation of regulatory authority vested in OLCC on the medical side, that we need the interface of the medical side on edibles, because those standards are, they're being market tested every day. And there's a lot of feedback from the producers about their product and what kind of standards they would like to be able to advertise and meet. So, I think we just need to open that communications avenue, and you'll get all the information you need. And I would bet that the folks currently producing edibles would be able to template rules for the recreational side.
Senator Cruz and then Co-Chair Burdick.
Not to contradict Senator Farioli, but to a degree, as far as content, potentially. But we're in an entirely different world on the recreational side. On the medical side, it's kind of, they're designing things for patients to a large degree. You're getting into packaging, you're getting into a whole lot of other issues. And I'm not necessarily saying we need to go slow, but we need to go slow enough to make sure we get it right and so we don't run into a lot of the other problems. And I think the list we're going to get Wednesday is going to help inform that. I personally believe we need to move cautiously so we're relatively sure of what we're doing as we move forward.
Quickly, but not fast.
Okay. Mentioned that this brought up an interesting question because the labs are going to be OLCC licensed labs. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right. And yet those same labs will be servicing the medical market. So how will that work out? Will the medical people, the way you envision this, will the medical marijuana dispensaries be able to use their own labs as they do now, or how will that work?
So, co-chairs and Senator Burdick, we don't have a position on the medical laboratories. We believe that it would make sense that you have one standard. But exactly who should govern that is I've seen various pieces of legislation around that, and at this point we've not taken a position on that legislation.
Yeah, and I can understand that, but getting to Senator Cruz's point, which is, I think is a really good point, is that we have the expertise out there, but we don't have the accurate potency information. So they know how to serve their clients, but it's kind of a dicey operation in terms of how much potency you're actually getting.
Senator Brzozinski.
I think just following up with Co-Chair Burdick on this, there is a lot of information that we can get, and I think that it can give us the basis, and then looking at the states of Colorado and Washington State as to what they've done on the retail side will also inform us. Clearly, we may want to go further than that as to trying to hone in as to the actual level of THC and the size of a dose that would be. But I think there's going to be some groundwork there that we can use and utilize, and they'll be able to get more information once we start honing in on these questions, exactly where we need that assistance. And I just have to believe that there's going to be some authority out there that will be able to help us do that.
It would also seem to me, just to follow up on that point, that when we get those labs, so that we're really getting accurate potency and accurate all kinds of testing, really a higher level of testing, that might actually be a marketing technique for the medical market, even if they weren't required to use those labs, that the medical population might prefer to go to dispensaries that use those kinds of labs.
Senator Brzozinski and then Senator Kreese?
I can't see how we can't have both the medical and the retail having the same standards, the same labs, because that's the only way that we get control and consistency throughout this whole process. And clearly, I'd be very frank, we have a lot of people that came in without the expertise, without the capital funding, that are doing lab work on the medical side. And what we know for sure is that you're getting completely different answers and different information from those. So it needs to be standard and uniform across the two disciplines.
I have the privilege of serving with the co-chair of this committee on the lab work group, and it will be one-stop shopping, and everybody will be tested. There's no other way to do this, and I think we're going to come up. Don't you think, Representative Leninger, with a really good product? We're getting really close to, this is going to be a system where not anybody's going to be able to jump in, because this is high-tech stuff.
Yep.
There's no question about that. And there are people out there now that can do it. We know that. And the way this will be set up, OLCC will license them, but the public health is going to be the one that certifies and inspects. So it's going to be a really good system. I'm very encouraged by the progress we've made so far.
I think that's true. I would say, and I agree with everything that you said, particularly the honor to serve with Co-Chair Leininger Barton. Just kidding. I think we are working on a good plan, but I think Co-Chair Burdick made an important point just now, and that is if OLCC is licensing the labs, and I do think we're going to have a great set of inputs for you all to work with. If you're licensing the labs that make medical edibles and you have a kind of a one-year delay from the point of operational activity on adult use edibles can be created, do we end up with a gap for medical patients who are used to getting edibles because we have created this unified system? And that would be a big problem, because a lot of medical patients really need to take their medicine through edibles. And so we've got some things to think through on that. Anybody have any other thoughts on that? So, all right, so we'll put that one in the parking lot for your list, which is going to resolve everything, I'm sure.
So co-chairs, we have a couple other ones that were not raised by the testimony, if we might. One is the insurance piece, and this is on page 14, lines 17 through 30. This was simply taken directly out of the alcohol, and I don't think that was what we wanted to do. This talks about, for the purpose of providing coverage for injuries relating to the conduct of an intoxicated person who were sold marijuana while visibly intoxicated. This is left over from the bar language of where if you are a bar and you continue to serve somebody who's intoxicated.
Right.
I think that what we were looking for was simply the ability to make sure that the businesses have in place all their own insurance that they need to have. We weren't going to tell them what it is, we weren't going to tell them what it looked like or how much, but just simply to have just a good business practice around insurance. So I would like to work with your staff to clean up that section.
May I jump in? Do we have concern that it's not possible to get insurance for the same reasons it's challenging to get bank accounts and possibly bonding?
Yeah, Co-Chair Representative Leininger. Yes, we have spent some time talking to various insurance companies and various medical marijuana businesses. You can get it. You go to Lloyd's of London, which is sort of the insurer of last resort. And again, the hope is that the marketplace wakes up to the fact that this business is coming and that they can start filling the void that is clearly there.
Okay. Any questions on that? Great.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I can't resist.
Please.
Maybe we can get bundling for our fire insurance program if we offer them the medical marijuana and the marijuana business.
Good synergy. Way to find efficiencies in government.
Bundling.
All right, then.
So, co-chairs, if I can raise another issue for you. Issue number 23 on your staff's list, which was to address some of the definitions around the term extracts and concentrates. The way the drafting occurred, we're a little nervous that we've defined extracts and marijuana products and the way they interact. And what we would like to do is the opportunity to, again, sit down with your staff and go through this portion of the definition line by line to make sure that everything works, particularly in light of Section 57, which says quite clearly that there can be no home extract work done. You can't make extracts at home. We just want to make sure that we're not stepping on that and creating trouble by what we define up on the front side of the bill. So we'd like the opportunity to look at that.
May I jump in on that? Does anyone have any questions on that provision? Because I've...
Go ahead.
I had a constituent raise with me concerned that there are some kinds of home extract making, you know, infused oil or something, infused wine, I believe, is the favorite example in the committee, but that might not require an OLCC license. And do you feel like there's a risk that the language as written is overly broad, or do you feel like it accounts for some of those more benign, non, you know, hazardous chemical related home uses?
Co-chair and Senator Representative Leininger, it's a good question. I don't know that I have an answer for it yet. Again, I think that's part of the problem is we need to make sure definitions at the very front of this measure work through everything as we move all the way through to the tail end and especially to Section 57.
Senator Pozanski.
So, Madam Co-Chair, if you remember, one of the things that we talked about is what we don't want is people blowing up or burning down their houses.
That's right.
So we're looking at the toxic tanes and stuff like that, petrochemicals, and we acknowledge that there are ways that people can actually extract the THC out of the plant without putting them or someone else or their property at risk. And I think that's what you're referring to, and I think that's what I understand in working with trying to get the definitions understood as to there's a difference between those different methods, and the ones we're very concerned with is the ones that are going to cause safety, public safety, and health issues.
Right. So those would be the ones under the auspices of...
Right. And the others who have been called out as not being extract in that sense.
Got it. That's a good point.
So that's all we have at this point.
Madam Chair.
To answer any other questions.
I've got some questions that weren't discussed by the committees.
Excellent, and me too. So this is our open season. I'm sorry, guys, that this is the part where we ask you questions that are just
without a cue.
A free-for-all.
I don't have any cheat seat in front of me.
And we're starting with the formidable Senator Farioli.
So this is a question for Mr. Marks. Could you describe the background check process for a OLCC liquor license?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Farioli. Check your license box, right? If you had a criminal background or you have a crime in your background, it's required. Then We will look at those. We will first do an in-state check on it. If something on the application warrants us going further, we will do a national background check. And in looking at that, because crimes aren't consistent between the states, and we'll look at ownership structures in the alcohol licensing process. Because crimes aren't consistent between the states, that actually sometimes requires this pretty intensive process of going back, looking at the state, looking at the charges, and sometimes looking at the disposition of them.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Do you do credit checks, background banking checks, other ancillary data source checks?
I will get back to you on what we do for our licensees specifically. I'm sorry, I'm more familiar with our contract stores and what we look at in their financials.
Madam Chair, the Dash ones don't really have any specificity with regard to what kind of rigor there will be in background checks for licensure.
Okay.
So I'm really curious, if we're going to do an analogy to the liquor side, I would expect it to be as rigorous as that, you know, perhaps not necessarily more rigorous, but at least we should have a description of what the background check protocol ought to be, not just for due diligence on our part, but so that applicants will know, you know, what the standards are going to be. May I?
Please do, yes.
I noticed that you've got the ability in the Dash ones to own marijuana, purchase it, resell it, you know, use it for all the purposes for which it might be necessary for you for testing purposes or whatever. Do you have seizure authority in the Dash ones? I didn't see it there. So if you got into a situation where you needed to confiscate, do you have the ability to seize?
Yeah. Co-Chair Senator Farioli, the confiscation of marijuana is on page nine, lines 2 through 6, and it allows us to confiscate as necessary for the commission to ensure compliance with enforcement provisions.
Right.
So we do have the ability to confiscate marijuana.
And in the Madam Chair, if I could continue.
Please do.
On the alcohol side, can you seize and sell?
So let me address one of you, co-chairs and Senator Farioli. You point out something that I missed in my comments. The language that allows us to seize product for the purpose of taxation and to turn around and sell it for the value of the tax is something that we did not ask for in this bill and think should be taken out. It was not our intent to ever seize marijuana and go out and sell it to anybody in any way, shape, or form. That's something that was clear in the drafters, and it's not something that we want to do. So that is something that's the tax collection, pages 21, line 30 through 22, line 17, needs to be cleaned up to take
Madam
that
Chair,
away.
If I could follow up.
Please do.
If the if we're ever going to do anything to thoroughly discourage the illicit market, somebody has to have the ability to seize and sell, so that the cost of the investigation and the prosecution is recovered, just as we would with any other situation. I mean, we seize and use vehicles that are used in crime. We seize and use cash assets that are used in crime. And I wouldn't think that we'd want to necessarily treat this any differently.
You know, Madam Chair, I mean, you're actually, Senator, just touching on the whole idea of the criminal and civil asset forfeiture. I mean, that we did 10 years ago. I mean, this could fit right into that.
Well, Madam Chair, it would certainly be a additional deterrent to the black market and to the diversion of product. Madam Chair, I only have two more little questions.
You've got great questions.
Before you move on, can I ask for a clarification? So as I hear it, you are arguing to take the language out, and you think it should stay in?
I do think it should stay in. I think it should be very clear that if we're going to regulate this commodity, we are serious about moving the production into the legal, regulated market. And without the other authority, you're basically encouraging diversion.
co-chairs and Senator Farioli, I think there are two issues here. One is the way the amendment is drafted says if a marijuana producer, grower, is delinquent in the payment of privilege tax, then OLCC can seize. What you're talking about is other seizures down the line.
Yes, I am.
Someone has too many products, someone has two other things. I think they're two separate issues, and I didn't want to confuse this. This is language that we specifically do not like to see in this bill about selling product for taxes. What you're raising is another question.
Yes, it is.
Of enforcement and using the seizure product for enforcement.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's an important distinction. Thank you for bringing that up.
And, Madam Chair, just the last two. On page 6, there's a clear prohibition against using recreational cannabis in a public place. And I know there's some interesting wrinkles about definitions of public places. For instance, I don't think it includes an automobile. I'm pretty sure it doesn't include a motorhome. I don't think it would include a tent. So I'd like to know what your thinking is relative to the definition of a public place.
Yeah. Co-chairs and Senator Farioli, we did ask that you include in this bill the open container language, and the committee decided not to move forward with that, or at least it was not moved forward in this.
Okay.
So it is on the other list of issues that we brought forward that were not addressed.
I'll leave that one for later because I think there's going to have to be some. In the licensure language, it says you cannot license a mobile marijuana dispensary or a mobile marijuana retail store. But what's interesting to me is that you don't have a requirement for a licensed facility to have four walls. You know, if you look on page 11, a marijuana recreational facility apparently could be licensed not in a permanent structure. I'm referring to lines 1 through 6.
Yeah.
A licensed premise does not need to be enclosed by a wall, fence, or other structure. And I was wondering if you had the beer garden model in mind when you drafted that provision.
Co-chairs and Senator Farioli, first of all, that is what the drafters of Measure 91 wrote, not us.
Yeah.
So, but we've interpreted that to mean that an outdoor grow could exist, that we would not have to have a structure, but we could impose a wall or a fence around an outdoor grow. If we were to license a retail establishment, at least in my mind, the rules would clearly say it is four walls and a roof, and you're going to stay inside those four walls and a roof, and the same for the processors.
So yeah, I may just have misinterpreted the close proximity to the word premise.
Yeah.
So this is a premise that doesn't need to have four walls, so it could be a tent. I mean, you'll have to clarify this for me.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That concludes my question.
Great. Senator Brzezinski.
Following what Senator Farioli said, it seems to me that when you are putting together for the different licenses that you're talking about, that you'll call out these different parts, because I understand how 91 was written to ensure that you could have outdoor grows versus indoor grows, but it's completely different for a retail outlet.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about the Peace Officer Authority, Section 31. And at around lines 29 through 30, it indicates that the peace officer authority extends to other laws of the state related to or regulating marijuana. And I'm wondering if that would extend to home grows, and if we envision that the OLCC, with its peace officer authority, might be, if the draft envisions, or if you envision, that OLCC staff would be doing enforcement around home grows, or creating citations for people if they had five plants instead of four, or not the right, or is that just ambiguity that we could clarify?
Madam Chair, for the record, Steve Marks. So this, just like our alcohol standards, right? And we could enforce other alcohol laws that, for instance, we don't enforce regularly today, like production of quantities of alcohol in your home, small quantities that are illegal that you're not permitted for. We rarely go out and try to enforce those laws, even though many homebrewers and distilleries are permitted. That's at least one, I think, pretty comparable interest here. But it's not that we don't have the authority to enforce other laws. We generally don't, and you don't see that in the record of what our enforcement regime is. And we can come back to you with the standards on how many criminal activities and what kind of charging our officers have done in the alcohol world.
So it is analogous to alcohol, mm-hmm. but it also does potentially extend to enforcement of home rules.
If I can just elaborate, so if you had somebody who instead of having four plants in their basement had 20 plants in their basement, which is way more than Measure 91 allows, are you saying that the OLCC would have jurisdiction over that?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, no, we were saying that OLCC would have authority to enforce. For instance, today, if there are criminal matters involved, our peace officers are trained to consult with local law enforcement and take those actions with local law enforcement. Now, if they originally discovered it, they would do something to take action at the scene and also bring in law enforcement for things that were outside our regulatory regime and outside the law, criminal activity that was there.
Any other questions, thoughts? Yes, sir, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Tom, just out of curiosity, Mr. Sugarman raised the point on the definitions that the removal of the definition of person. Do you have any background on why the definition of person?
Co-Chair, Representative Buckley, I do not. It was something that LC decided to do, and I don't know why.
Okay.
It was not our request.
You're pro people.
Pardon?
You're
pro-people.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So we have the hearing on this. Thank you very much for your information. Yeah. Mr. Marks, do you have any
comments? Let me just add one thing on the criminal background checks. We're putting together a whole series of policy comparisons about what we do on alcohol and how we might achieve background checks within this system. We're looking to there are some automated ways to check backgrounds, so it's an issue that we're going to be raising with Representative Buckley and Ways and Means as we look at how this ties in with our technology and what we want to do. So the kinds of checks we can or the kinds of checks we can do come at different costs. Here.
Senator,
I understand that Steve and Tom are coming back on Wednesday to fill in some blanks. Are we also going to continue to maybe look at this draft at that time for additional questions?
Yes, this will be an evolving process. We can take up questions that we have on Wednesday, and then next week when Shannon, the attorney for OLCC, comes back, I want to bring her in front of the committee to address some of these issues as well.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, if I could just follow up. Co-Chair Burdick asked myself and Representative Helm to be working on emergency language to have emergency inspection of records, and so we're working with Mr. Crawford. He's taking the lead for us to check in with some of the different agencies such as the Board of Pharmacy as to what they may have for controlled substance records at pharmacies to get us the guidance that we need, and then we'll get something to you so we can put into as an amendment.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
So we have, yes, Representative Buckley.
It's a process question to the co-chairs. We've heard a number of different ideas about concerning this bill tonight, and at some point I'm sure amendments will be drafted and considered. Would you like the committee to basically be going through the two of you in terms of possible amendments so that we not you know, having all of us hit LC, or how would you like to proceed in possible amendments to this?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because that is the most efficient way to go through the co-chairs on amendments. And we will at some point have a dash two, which hopefully will include your work and your work, Senator Helm, Representative Helm. And we have to make sure that we stay coordinated and that we don't have our drafter running off on all kinds of different tangents.
So within that framework, we have the amendment. We have some language under drafting right now for the lab standards piece that may end up as an amendment to this. And then we've got an itemized list of comments people have raised just now, the public comments, and in addition, thoughts from the committee and from Mr. Marks and Mr. Burns. And so I anticipate that we'll be talking through how to reflect that in drafting, and we'll get that going. But it will be an iterative process. So if there are, you know, there will be an opportunity for us to discuss this further on Wednesday and probably into next week, so that we can capture the good thinking of people in the room and on the committee. It's an exciting first step.
It is, and Madam Chair, I think what I would like to see is to get our thoughts together after tonight's hearing, get your work product and get the lab work product, and hopefully by early next week to have a dash two amendment that we can look at that addresses some of these concerns. It's always better when you have actual language in front of you.
Good. Any other comments before we close? All right, then I'll close the public hearing and we'll adjourn until Wednesday. Thank you. Adjourn until Wednesday. Thank you.